How would you like to make the first million today? We have Rice saying with us, and he is the VP of the new product at Mozilla, leading new 0-to-1 product initiative. So he joined Mozilla in 2022 by the acquisition of his startup Pulse, which developed AI meeting summarization models. So Raz had been repeat consumer-focused startup founder, and he was co-founder and CEO of Tempo AI, a smart calendar acquired by Salesforce in 2015. He also co-founded All the Cooks, which became the largest recipe community on Android before his acquisition took part. So either in his career, he served as VP of Business Development at Skyfire, a mobile browser acquired by Opera, and prior to this, Rad co-founded and exited a startup in the ringtone, live video, and college dating categories. Wow, he's also writes about AI product management, startups, and VC in Twitter and LinkedIn. So, Raj, wow, what an extensive and impressive career. We're going to have an amazing conversation. And so, can you tell us, what are the 5 steps you recommend tech entrepreneurs in order to make the first million or to get to product market fit?
Welcome to Unstoppable Podcast with Harry Sardinas, inspiring conversations with influential millionaires, investors, thought leaders, entrepreneurs who are making a massive difference with their innovative products and services, and sharing the challenges and wisdom of how they sold their first million.
So I just wrote down 5, like right now, a few minutes ago. So I imagine there's probably dozens of things, but here's some things that came up to mind or sort of came to mind initially. I think the first thing, and I see this a lot, is work on something you're genuinely passionate about. It's not uncommon, when you enter year 2 and 3, it's really painful. So if you don't feel like you can grind it out, because grit is probably a defining trait of most entrepreneurs. If you don't feel like you can grind it out, you're probably not going to make it. So make sure you really care about this problem. They say fall in love with your customer. I don't care if the customer is yourself, but make sure you really love this problem, that whatever you're attacking, that you really want to solve it. Mission-driven founders are the hardest to compete against. I think the second thing is 5 users or 50 users. It's actually not a lot. If you have 25,000 in revenue, it's not much. It's almost nothing. And so the reason I say that is the amount of risk you should take should be proportional to your stage. And a lot of times people will be like, oh, I don't want to make this change because I got 25 active users. If you're not growing in step functions, you're not growing at all, right? And so you're failing, you're basically losing, right? And so what I like to tell people is take risk. We need step functions. Don't be afraid to shut a feature down that looks like it's on the edge and but it's not working, whatever, right? So that's sort of the second thing. I think the third thing, which is a more recent thing, is I've seen, and this is a positive, AI has been incredible in this sort of work. And it's absolutely been an accelerant for getting work done. But AI is a thought partner, it's not a thought delegation tool, right? So human judgment and taste is still super important. And I think people have to think about that, right? Because if 3 companies are building products and they're all leaning on AI, why is there still winners and there's still some losers, right? So in the end, human taste, judgment, creativity all come into play. And so it's important to make sure you apply that and take a step back and just not over lean on the AI and get infatuated with the AI, but not spending the time to say, you know what, I'm going to go talk to users myself. The fourth thing, which I see a lot of things that cause traps early on, is the noise. There's a lot going on. You might get FOMO. You might see hundreds of competitors. So many entrepreneurs, so many founders give up early because of the noise, and you actually have to zone it out. And one of the biggest traps is you see what somebody else does and you're like, I'm going to do what they're doing because it's working for them. That doesn't mean it's going to work for you. It's like completely the wrong logic, and usually it doesn't work. And so what I tell people is it's fine to peek up and raise your head once in a while and take a look at what's going on out there, but focus on your version of how you want to solve this and what your users are telling you, because you're reaching a different segment, a different audience. And that'll likely yield the sort of best result. And then the fifth thing is when you find something that seems like it's working, start running. don't slow roll it. If you need to spend money to put ads against it, or you need to spend money to see if you can accelerate it or make this work or whatnot, do it. Because many times you've gotten in a mental mindset where you've taken a very conservative approach because it's been a struggle. And so you stay in a conservative mode, but now you have something that's kind of working. It's all about speed and it's a race, right? So if you figured out a way to make acquisition work, then go crazy on it and put your energy there. Spend your energy on what matters. Don't spend your energy on what on long tail things.
So you have exited several times, which is already hard to exit in a tech company once. Most of the great majority of tech entrepreneurs never achieved that, and you have done it several times. Now, 1 out of 5 podcast guests that come to this podcast, multimillionaires, they are tech millionaires. And people might think, 1 out of 5 are tech millionaires, 1 out of 5 are property millionaires. The rest is, they are marketing, people that own products in different industries. Bottom line, people might be listening to the podcast and say, well, if 1 out of 5 millionaires come to Harry podcast are in tech, and I want to be a millionaire, that's easy. I'm going to build a tech business and I'm going to become a multimillionaire. So we want to hear from you that have exited several times, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the tech businesses, to give a little bit of perspective to our audience.
I want to make sure I understand the question. The good, the ugly, and the bad of the tech business. Can you share more?
What are the good, the bad, and the ugly of being a tech entrepreneur?
I would say,
and if it's done easy, and if it is done easy to become a tech multimillionaire.
I think there's multiple questions here, and so I want to make sure I tackle them independently. To answer your last question first, I think being an entrepreneur, no matter what you do, is really hard. I don't care if you're a tech entrepreneur. I don't care if you're a restaurant business owner. I don't care if you're starting your local crew. Whatever it is, it's hard. Like, you know, you have to juggle a lot of things. You don't have support staff. You've got payroll to worry about. You have to grow. You have to, people don't show up. Work doesn't deliver on time, quality degrades, whatever, who knows? You have to market all these sorts of different things. I think just being an entrepreneur is difficult. Now, tech specifically, you know, I think it certainly attracts a certain audience of people who like change, people who like to work with software, people like digital. I mean, you know, I think one of the neat things about tech is how fast change is. Like the way you, you know, sweat two copper pipes together hasn't really changed. Maybe they've introduced PECs or new forms of piping, but it hasn't really changed. But the way you build software changes every year, every 6 months, every few years, right? And so people who are really comfortable in change and playing on the cutting edge, I think all very sort of amazing. I think one of the downsides of tech is, you know, we are the sort of cultural trend line. Like, you know, like tech was kind of a side quest 25 years ago, but now it's like front and center. There's tech founders, there's celebrities, and they're as mainstream as Hollywood in sort of a different way. And they have influence, and the decisions the tech industry does as a whole and the things we do can really impact people, whether it deals with privacy, monetization, a lot of things that we align by within Mozilla in terms of protecting sort of people from the data hoarders, for lack of a better term. And so I think, you know, tech, you know, since tech and the singular goal is always make money when you're in a business, unfortunately, that often means you're playing in gray areas and you're playing on edges that are not comfortable. And, you know, you're building addictive things because you know how human psychology works, right? And so there's a lot of sort of trade-offs in tech. I think those are your different questions. I don't know if I answered all of them, but let me know.
Yeah, and then, Raj, it's good thing is very scalable, but also the other thing is because the way that we do software now, which is, I think, that's the other question. It's technical. I would like to ask it to you. Some people are saying that because we have AI now, it's easier than ever to build an MVP. That it used to be before, that you need a lot of resources to create that minimum viable product. On the other hand, other people are saying that if you build in tech, still you have, from the tech point of view, it has to work amazing, and AI can help you, but still have to be pretty hands-on in terms of what new product you're going to bring. So what's your perspective on creating an MVP? Is that is as easy as before, or still, if you want to have your MVP that actually works and gets some traction, still there is a lot of hands-on and AI won't be able to help you that much?
I think the framing I like is, yes, building software has never been easier than before, but knowing what to build has been as hard as ever. And it's very easy to generate.
Oh, wow, that's very profound.
Yeah. It's very easy to generate slop, right? We are in the AI slop generation era. And when I mean slop, I don't mean just content. I don't mean social media posts. I mean even apps. So much of the internet is basically the disposable internet. I mean, we don't know what websites are real, what websites are stale. So many applications that have been published in the App Store haven't been updated in 5 years, right? These are basically dead, or for lack of a better term, effectively dead apps that are just sort of cluttering or creating spam across the ecosystem. And that's why we had things like Google that could distill what's relevant, what's important right now. And obviously that's moving into AI with LLM chat, whether it's ChatGPT or other. For sure, if you look at the product development process across organizations, they're building prototypes faster than they ever have before. For sure, they're leveraging AI in every step of the process, but there's still a ton of taste and judgment that goes into what should we build. And there's still a rubric that I like to think about when deciding, are you building for internal? Are you building just for test purposes? Are you building for production? Are you building code that needs to be readable and maintained by multiple people? And there's a series of questions behind that. And that really influences how you even approach this, right? Am I AI one-shotting, or am I using AI but using human code reviewers and whatnot? So I think it depends, but absolutely it's been disruptive.
I agree with you.
In a positive way to the entire process.
I agree with you, Rajan. Let me tell you the a story that happened to me the other day.
Harry, did I lose you?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, we
hear. I can hear you, but I don't see your video.
Can you hear me now? Yeah.
I can hear you fine.
So the other day, a hairdresser came to me and she showed me her app, a referral app that she's creating, and she wants to bring it to market. And I actually saw it, and it works pretty good. But I was telling her, look, do you know what you're getting into? You're going to need a million to have a chance in this industry. Is you can say, okay, I'm gonna make this app and I'm gonna help, but exactly like you said, those questions that is a market there are different solutions already for that kind of problem solving at the moment, and with the big players already on board. And yeah, the app does exactly the same that all of those companies. So basically you have to battle face to face. And I told her, you have to find a way to pivot this, to make it more personal to you, to make it unique in some way. But you jumping into a space, being a hairdresser, and trying to build a tech app, this is, and I think that what it comes is maybe the people see the news, okay? And like you said, the tech becomes celebrities and everybody, even listen, our listeners for the podcast, that's why I ask you the question, say, okay, if one out of five that multimillionaires become a multimillionaire in tech is easy, what we can agree on is when you hit the right spot, it's a good vehicle to build wealth, same like property, because it's a scalable, things like that. When you are on point. Now that you just point out, Raj, which is easy to build, but what has become a huge challenge is what to build that is actually unique, or is actually that would be a big disruption. Everyone, I help a lot of tech startup to grow, and every tech company you talk, they say, no, we are we have a disrupting technology, and said, look, today, in today's world, to create something disruptive have become more challenged. So what's the future? What do you think the future? A lot of people are also saying that could be a unicorn out there only with one tech entrepreneur and the rest using AI agents. What's your take on this?
One of the things that slows you down the most in any product development process is human alignment. And that's very much about getting people on a board, making sure everyone agrees what we want to build, making sure we pass the sort of different QA and quality controls and whatnot. And so there's a certain freedom that comes to being a solo builder. Because when you're building alone, you're making those decisions. You decide, you trust your own judgment, your own taste, right? And so I think that's unlocked a lot of desire to effectively see how far I can go solo and then bring in a series of agents to act and handle different parts of my workflow. Do I think you can do that at scale on a large business? Unlikely. You're going to need help. There's no way around it. And people have to manage these agents and they need feedback loops and they need to be improved and things change and the market's dynamic and whatnot.
I mean, right, Raj? Those agents need to be trained for the people that have the expertise. Is that correct?
I don't know if I'd use the word train, but effectively there's a feedback loop, right? You create an agent, it does customer support, it gets things wrong. It's like, hey, why did we get this wrong? We need to consider this and this, et cetera, right? So there's a feedback loop. So you can call at some level, they call this evals, running basically the evaluations and determining how to improve it over time, give it more context, et cetera. All that said, for sure, it's more empowering than it's ever been. And you're going to see a lot of solo builders, and we can get to points where you can build small scale things solo or with one or two people. And I think that's very empowering. And, you know, I wouldn't discount the hairstylist just because he or she's a hairstylist. They can build too, right? I think the hard thing is knowing what to build.
He's actually built very good. The thing works
exactly,
amazing.
Yeah. For sure.
It was like, working amazing.
I would actually even call out that the occupation doesn't matter as much anymore as the archetype. Mm-hmm. Are you a curious person? Are you someone who wants to learn and figure it out? Are you a little bit of a hacker or hustler? Are you comfortable with data, right? And you know, are you a builder ultimately, right? But what I guess I'd say is, irrespective of whether you can build it, you still need to use your own taste and judgment and say, like, do we have an insertion point? Do we have a way we can win? The hardest thing right now is growth and distribution. Because building has never been easier before. So how do you stand out in that market? And you know, that's the million-dollar question. How do you drive growth and distribution?
Exactly. Distribution have become the whole point, yeah. And it is things that, going back to the hairdresser, Raj, I think that the building part has evolved a lot. Spectacular, I would say. Like even to the point exactly that hairdresser created something that it was working without fall, without flow. It was amazing. I saw it with my, however, that distribution part, understand, and this is where we're coming, to get product market fit and to get distribution in tech. If you don't know what you're doing, not even a million for an app, right? Because not even having a million to direct to consumer, how, because I asked her this question. I said, how much is it costing you to acquire a client for your thing? And she said, Harry, I don't have the number. I said, well, this is the thing. How many users? No, I have these users. Okay, so how much I cost them? No, I don't have. I cannot answer you this question. I said, well, this is the kind of question that now it comes to your mind because your thing actually works. And Raj, it comes to distribution and it comes like somebody is in love with the application, but they don't understand or they don't have experience or they don't understand how that distribution, how to get to market works. You give them even $1 million and they will be able to do very little with it because sometimes, especially direct to consumer, it's need a big numbers. I always tell them maybe start better for B2B, right? Which is maybe would be a path, right? Unless that you have experience in distribution, unless that you have experience in go-to-market, unless that you know how to pivot. So what's your advice or what is your message for those tech entrepreneurs listening to a podcast now that they're facing with the problem that we have today, which is go-to-market and distributions? Like a lot of millionaires that came here, tech millionaires, when I asked them the background, they said, no, we are experts in marketing and sales. I said, how come you're a tech millionaire? Well, I understand what the market wants. I understand what they're going to pay for it. And I understand what product they want. So then I had a small tech team to develop exactly what they want and go there and sell it. And that's how they become multimillionaire. And interesting, the tech, the software developers that came here, and they are also millionaires, they spend the whole podcast talking about distribution. Harry, this is how I find my first client. This is how I get in love with it. This is how I get to market. This is how I pivot. This is the strategy that I use. And they're so passionate more about how they went to market than actually the tech, which is for me shocking, because you said, look, you're a developer. I was expecting that you're going to spend the whole hour talking about coding and about all things. And it becomes even harder because the fact that you become a developer in the first instance is because you want to be alone in front of the computer and you don't want anybody to bother you, and you don't definitely don't want to talk to strangers. And to get to distribution or product market fit, you need another personality. You need someone that's out there every day talking about the thing with everybody and getting feedback and getting no's and getting yes and everything. So what is your message for those tech founders that they are stuck and they're looking for distribution channels to get to product market fit or to get to the first minute?
I don't think all tech people choose to be an engineer to sit in front of a computer. I think engineering is a very creative exercise, which happens to also often happen in front of a computer. But
I'm a chemical engineer.
Yeah, but I guess what I was going to say is, you know, I mean, I think 2025, 2026 is very different to pre-2025, 2026. Like pre-Gen AI era, the B2B growth playbook, you find a problem and you figure out how to reach and sell to that audience. Now, I think that's still true today, but it's more crowded and enterprise has optionality. For the first time, they can go, hey, do I want to build this myself or do I want to buy something? And the fact that they can even think about building themselves is an incredible unlock, but it's only enabled because of Gen AI. So I think talking to folks and what their sales motion has looked like in 25, 26 would be quite different to talking to folks that had, you know, let's say made their first million prior to that. You know, I think a lot about consumer because that's been where most of my domain experience has been. And in consumer, you know, historically, there was a number of motions around SEO, now answer engine optimization, social media proof, trust, paid acquisition, things like that. And all those channels are getting flooded at the top. And I think a lot of consumer founders are almost over-indexing on that, along with, you know, B2B, SaaS founders, developer tools, et cetera, et cetera. I think an area that's gotten forgotten because we've become over-reliant on AI is actually coming back to just sort of consumer psychology and PLG. Like, why would somebody want to tell this app to their friend? Like, why would they want to share it? Is this app, does good word of mouth optimization? Does this app experience improve if I invite somebody? Like, is there a built-in loop, right? And so I think those kinds of things, I think people have de-indexed on because they've become so focused on AI and execution. It's like, oh, I can blog through AI, so I'm going to spend more energy there, and I can run ads through AI, whatever. And that's all great. And I think that's the new table stakes. But I think there's so much at the top of the funnel now. Ultimately, it's going to come back to trusted referral. And so I think that's where time needs to be spent, especially if you're thinking about more consumer and frankly, a lot of B2B SaaS acquisition now, particularly new companies, right? I'm not talking about mature established brands.
So what is your opinion on software as a service solutions that were doing really well, like you said, prior to 2025, 26, and now are some indication, exactly like you said, that people are saying, well, do I really need this software as a service? Do I need this SaaS, or should I build it myself? So what future do you think for the software as a service? Some people, I need to admit, some people was that the whole industry, they are decreasing the value, but I don't know about this, about the as a service, have since the AI appearance. So what is it for the software as a service versus building myself?
You know, I think obviously a lot of work has shifted from interacting with whatever enterprise web application is in place and doing work through a terminal window or through some bespoke application that you built. And this has all been enabled because of AI. And it's an incredible unlock because people can build personalized workflows and experiences exactly how they want to do it. They want to interact with their CRM. They don't want to use Salesforce for whatever reason. They can still use Salesforce behind the scenes, but they interact with it through their own bespoke web application or through a terminal window or whatever it might be. And that's just been an incredible unlock. But the fact that you can build the UI layer and the SaaS tools that have really just become systems of records really changes how you should think about pricing, where energy should be spent, how the teams are organized and whatnot. I can imagine Salesforce spending time thinking about, hey, should
privacy and security also, right?
Yeah, across the board. I mean, every, you know, whether it's Sentry for like security tools or whatnot, I mean, you know, things are moving into a terminal sort of a window. It doesn't mean that the infra layer and all of that work doesn't need to be done. But my point is, how much front-end engineering work should Salesforce invest in versus pushing things into a command line interface or into an MCP to make it more agent-friendly and then let the customers decide how they want to use these systems and what they want to build? And so I feel this is certainly creating pressure on SaaS, as particularly on like higher-end SaaS, where they have been largely systems.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard, right? Yeah.
But what I'll say is on lower-end SaaS, the fact is we do have a buy versus build decision. If you're a small company, you may decide you don't want to even use Salesforce. You want to roll your own because you just need 1% of the feature set, right? The fact that you even have that optionality, now, it is double-edged. A lot of these organizations aren't thinking about the maintenance cost that's associated with that and keeping it up to date and as new features come in and things like that, right? So I think it's, right now, all of this stuff is in motion. But for sure, SaaS companies are thinking about that. And the fact that an enterprise can go to a SaaS and as a buyer can sort of say, you know what, I have a buy versus build optionality that's actually real versus before I didn't really have a build option. You can imagine that's creating some price compression. And at the same time, these organizations are seeing absurd amounts of usage because of agents interacting with Salesforce doing thousands of things, more so than a human would do, right? So they're also thinking about, well, how do I reconcile that? And so they're looking at usage-based pricing models, which could also think. So I think this is all developing. It's in flow, but it's certainly the way it was pre-2024 is no longer the case.
So changing the industry so fast, what could share with those tech entrepreneurs looking for funding? Because we have that dynamic, this that we used to see a lot in tech, building that MVP, the number one, everybody forget about the M's. They don't create an MVP, they create a big elephant. And after, when all the money, time, and resources are exhausted, then they come to you to say, look, invest, because we need the money to sell it. And you are like, how am I going to invest on this? You guys don't even know if anybody want to buy this in the first place. No, but this is the problem. The problem is here. The problem is here, but nobody use it yet. So what are the things that tech founders should be have checked before they go and seek investment today for a VC?
You know, it's funny because investment for the first time in so many years, I wouldn't call it a negative signal, but the fact that many entrepreneurs are deciding to not raise money, I think is incredibly empowering. Now, of course, that's difficult if you need to spend your full day working on this thing, you can't do it on the side or whatnot, and that impacts your day-to-day income. But AI has become empowering in that way. And I think as a result of that, there is a little bit of this sort of self-selection that's going on where you go to a seed investor and they're like, well, why are you pitching me for money? Because it's sort of like, were they not able to figure it out on their own? But at the same time, they have money they have to deploy. And not every seed investor is going to be able to get Anthropic secondaries or whatever, which is everyone's trying to pile into. So I think at early stage venture, it's been an incredibly challenging market. And I think they also know that things are changing suddenly. And very fast. And so it's very hard, you know, when you're in the business of trying to predict what the future is going to look like, but the future is like rapidly changing underneath you at levels that we've never seen before. Very, very difficult. And later stage companies, you know, they're dealing with some of this, right? Not everyone can just say, hey, I'm just going to pile everything into like three AI companies that are.
Early stage investors, right? Out of the 500 billionaires that we interviewed this podcast, early stage investors only chose one or two. And one of them was specialized in property tech only. So imagine. So when they come and say, look, you're very rare species, I've become really challenged, right?
I don't know if I followed what you said there. What was the last sentence?
Like I said to the early stage investors that they are a rare species.
Oh, rare they species. I got you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got you.
They are very rare nowadays, right?
I don't think they're rare. I think there's a lot of money floating out there. People are trying to figure out where to put it. I think it's just hard. Like, I think it's always been hard. Usually at the early stage, you're betting on people. You're not betting on ideas. Like, can this person figure it out? But I think the part that's hard right now is why running this very simple litmus test, like, will ChatGPT do this? Will Claude do this? Right. And so I actually think, weirdly, there's a renaissance for stuff again, because it's an area they're not swimming. Whereas work software is getting absolutely clobbered in different ways, because you should fully expect that, Claude will release something for CRM, right? They're not. I saw this really interesting definition of platform. If it's a platform, it means all the companies or tools that are built on top of you collectively generate more revenue than you. But that's not the case here. People building on top of OpenAI or Claude, ultimately they're bringing those use cases into OpenAI or Claude, right? And so it's in some ways they're not really platforms, right? They're, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but that's kind of a bear case. I'm not trying to, I want an optimistic picture.
How about the little boy versus the big tech? I also hear that people are saying, well, don't build, because if you build, as soon as big tech notice that you have, they can very quickly more resources than you. If you're using it yourself, there are hundreds of people using AI also, and they can they clear the space really quickly, so there's no point to build anymore. And if you're building, you're gonna grow only until big tech spot you, and they either buy you out, or is this always have been the case, or do you think it's more challenging now for people building something from scratch to actually make it through without big tech can I mean develop something similar, right?
This has always been the case. This is the same, I'm going to call it nonsense, that you might hear from investors, like, oh, what if big tech does it? I'm sure, fine. I mean, that's always been the case. The issue is not whether big tech does it. I mean, every big tech is, at this point, there's almost nothing they're not doing. The issue is, do they think of it as a priority? And usually they can only do 10 or so things well at one time, right? And if you're not on the sort of top 10 priority list, they're not going to look at what you're doing for a long while. And by that point, you've carved out some sort of insertion point. You've now eaten 1, 2, 3% of the market. And then at that point, they might want to move in. But of course, there's going to be player two, player three, player four that's going to be like, hey, we need something now. And that's where you see a number of acquisitions. I think what's become harder is the IPO track. They still happen, but it is, it's always been challenging, and it will still stay challenging, but they're still going to happen.
So it has become more easy, more harder, or kind of the same? Because that's again what you describe is a very valid point. Big tech always have been there, and so it have making worse or easier for tech founders
I
to
would say
navigate
it's the
through.
same. I don't think I'm actually like, I would say, and in fact, it's more of a macro comment. When I was building stuff in 2000, the challenges were very different, right? You didn't really have internet. It was like you didn't have access to data learning. You had to talk to people physically. You had to go and physically visit a data center to like set up your server. And if you had to make a change, you had to go there. I mean, it was a completely different world, right? When I was in like
Oh,
04, it was
wow.
different. When I was building
Wow.
in 08, it was different, right? In 12, it was different, right? So every sort of few years, it's totally different. And each of them had different sets of challenges, right? It's not like what worked yesterday works today. Certainly, there's some pattern matching and intuition. And certainly, I've been through enough rodeos where I can kind of see some patterns, but I also remind myself that patterns are also anti-patterns, right? So you just don't know. It's good to know it's from a case study perspective, but it's also chaos theory, like what we do it when you, if you did the same steps again, it may have been a totally different result. So I think it's really changed. It's always been challenging to be a founder entrepreneur, and I don't think that's going to change. I do love the fact that things are more democratized now, so more people have access, but I don't think the work and grit and what's involved to be successful has changed at all.
Also, to the statements that I hear a lot, AI is gonna take my job and things like this. I think that, before we didn't have mobile phones, and because we have mobile phones, the apps came, and now hundreds of thousands of people work every day developing apps and things for those phones that didn't even exist before. And I saw companies, have seen companies firing people because of AI, and then it's trying to rehire them again because now they don't have this human factor, exactly like you said, that if AI make a mistake, somebody had to let it look, don't do it like that. I think an AI, I see AI as an amplifier of what you actually have. Like, for example, in my company, we have the same team. However, what we're teaching them and training them is how to work with the agents and how to train those agents. And so they have become easy. I'm telling them, look, now you talk with the agents and you guide them before you actually have to do it. But still, I need you to sit in front of the computer to just be doing a little bit before you have to do all the thing manually. But you have to sit there, and that's what I was speaking with my team. It's an amplifier rather than a job. Now in Miami, for example, you see some cars driving without a driver, right? And people are actually taking them. They are cheap, you know, because you don't have to pay the driver, right? So. What do you think about, what is your view in this AI is taking our jobs? Is it actually more than a campaign to escape people because now the companies can put more pressure on workers to make them perform more? Is it really the case? And yes, some jobs will be lost, but do you think that other ones will be created because of AI, or how do you see them? The marketplace.
Yeah, I think it's hard to answer this question. Everything is changing so fast. I think there should be more wealth distribution. I think there's going to be more entrepreneurs and builders than ever before. Right now, when you have your HOA and your pool committee, and you used to have to go buy some software, and you can go build your own. You have your local jujitsu gym, and you can go build your own for them and sell it. Right. So I think that's very empowering on one hand. I think within larger organizations, I think they're recognizing. Right now, a lot of the effort has been around AI as a tool to accelerate your work. So focused around productivity, but there's also how do you organize a team around being more AI native? And I think as part of that, you're going to see maybe the death or end of like two pizza teams, right? You know, 6 to 8 person teams, right? You might start seeing, I'm not saying they're going to die. You're still going to have those teams, but you're going to have increasingly one person teams or two person teams, like very small teams, because of the stage at which they're building, or you just don't need a full stack of people around it, you know, whatnot, right? You know, code doesn't have to be readable, it's internal tools, I mean, who knows, right? And so I think this organizational redesign is gonna create compression. At the same time, there's hiring, because in different parts of the org, they have to add more because they're scaling. It's not like these companies are saying, hey, with AI, we're gonna build less. No, they're gonna build more. Their aspirations are gonna get bigger. They're not trying to become unicorns, they're trying to become decacorns now, right? So the aspirations have climbed, they're building more. And this is the new table stakes. Everyone else is building at this speed too, right? So I think, you know, we're in a little bit of that messy middle where some companies are sort of figuring out where they're at while at the same time hiring. I think there's also, unfortunately, ranges of people that don't want to change their workflow. And I think that's very difficult in this environment. Like, I think it's important to think about how you can use AI to accelerate your workflow. Or leverage in certain ways. It's a different part of the brain you have to exercise, very much around systems thinking and automation and how different things work together and repeatable platform. And, you know, very different to maybe what comfortable doing it before. But, and so some of that is happening too, right? Where some people are getting kind of weeded out, right? But like, I think net is there's going to be more jobs and more businesses. Will they all pay as well as like top tier big tech? Probably not, right? You know, you know, I think a lot of people point at top tier big tech as like, oh, this is why it's all coming down. But like, yeah, maybe they're going to compress a bit, but there's going to be a bunch of opportunities in a longer tail. But unfortunately, they just may not pay as well, right? You know, because the environment has changed. And I think the other thing we're conflating is we think about, you know, we don't look at the post sort of COVID impact, like remote work. We know how to hire remotely. The pool has gotten wider, right? We can get people from different parts of the world, right? So the talent base has gotten wider. So I think all of those things are also playing into effect, right? Which we're conflating. It's happening at the same time. And so that's certainly created a more competitive environment. So I think this combination of things may make it feel like the way you're described, that some people have described it. But I think overall, every agent needs a human. I love that quote. Somebody had said that, I think, on Twitter, and I liked it. And I think it's true. Like, every agent needs somebody to supervise and monitor and improve it. And we're not at a point of AGI or ASI for that matter, where we're now the executors and AI itself is doing the strategy. We're a long way from that.
Exactly. And changing the workflow, right? And I think this is our challenge. Our challenge with your team, but also depend on the culture, okay? Because if you have a team that I might want, right, is a culture in my company that we are very little and we do a lot of things, and we always do something new. Like, for example, this podcast, when I spoke with my team, I said I want to do a podcast. They told me, what is this? I said, I don't know. We're just going to do it. And they told me, okay, wait 3 weeks and we'll figure it out. And after 3 weeks, they came back and told me, Harry, just press a button, record, that's it. Forget about it. It will go to all your social media. It will go to everything. Don't worry about it. They did even this cool thing for my background. You know what I mean? So now when I'm telling them, look, we have to work with these agents and with this AI, then we have to change the workflow and start to understand the idea that maybe could be a possibility that rather than you actually do things, you just need to talk and verify, and this is now how your job is going to be, which I think is easy for them, right? And they become, rather than the doers, they become like managers, right? But that is the culture in my company. You go to culture there, the people don't want to change. There is legacy, not only in people, in technology and equipment as well. You see some banks there, or you see some big companies there that people are challenging, moving the things to cloud, to the and people don't want to change. And now probably you need a better computer to process all this AI and everything. And now no. People don't want to change the computer. They don't want to change the workflow. They don't want to change the way they do things. And I think that this is maybe where the firing or the losing job of the people can hit. But if you have a company culture that is proactive, that and is willing to adopt new changes and to the change that the tech will provide, I think that those companies will survive. So last question about that one, because every tech founder that I speak with, when I tell them, if you want to start all over again, what would you do better? They always tell me, Harry, culture. I said, what, culture? Yeah, if I knew that's going to be 10 times, 100 times harder, and so tough, I would be paying more attention to the culture and to the people that started and what kind of culture I want to build in my organization. Which is something that you were talking also about, people alignment and how to do together and everything. This is, at the beginning, this is a challenge of tech, because, you know, when you are a few guys, you're working Monday to Sunday and you want to change the world and you don't care, you just passionate about the whatever you're building. Then when you scale to more people, those people that are willing to work Monday to Sunday, they need to, so now you have a culture transition and things like this, and it's a male-dominated environment. A statistic came to me that in women in tech founders, they were telling me that was 4% only versus men. Now they said that 2%, that is down. I said, how come it's down? Should be up on this. And it became even worse now, tech founder for women. So how do you see culture and diversity in this assisted today in terms of funding and thing is dominated. Some people always also telling me that those AIs, they have bias because, you know, the people that train those algorithms, they have some cultural, we can say, backgrounds, right? And the whole thing before perform on the bias, and so we have bias, culture, and diversity. So what is your point on this in tech moving forward? They think we're going to progress or move backwards. With women in tech, in finance, VC, and we move backwards, as I heard.
Yeah, I mean, there's like a few different questions here. Culture in an organization has always been critical. And the analogy I like to use is if you had the same product in the three different teams, one will win. What is it that they did differently? Did they make better decisions? Did they have better culture? You know, and I like to think about each person on the team having some sort of superpower, and a lot of it really about organizing your team in a way to win. So creating maximum amounts of alignment. So I don't think that's changed at all. And in this execution's become cheaper, driving alignment, getting to an agreement, having healthy debate, having diverse opinions and perspectives and lived experiences, I think all matter, right? Because they influence ultimately the product you want to build. You want to get as many different perspectives. Like, that's a good thing. And then you want to make a judgment. So I think have not changed. Diversity, I mean, you know, diversity means a lot of things, right? There's like, you're talking about gender diversity, there's ethnic diversity, there's income diversity, there's ideological diversity. In general, what I have found is in early stage startups, there is a natural tendency that the first 10 or so people are very similar in the way that you think, right? There's a strong cohesion because you have a certain way of operating and you want comfort. So you tend to hire people that not necessarily physically look like you, but think like you, right? Like think like they like, well, we need to operate 996 and this is how we make decisions and everything's going to be quant-driven or whatever it is, right? And typically as an organization expands, you know, that's not going to sustain that, right? And so you start getting more diverse perspectives, different opinions, different lived experiences. And in general, I think those are good things because I think it actually challenges the status quo, which is missing in that first 10. But with that also comes new processes you have to set up, right? Because now all of a sudden, everyone doesn't agree that we should, you know, approach something this way, right? And now we have to like, okay, how do we resolve this? And so they start creating single-threaded owners and they start creating, you know, decision briefs, and they start creating processes by which things are decided and how contention is resolved and different organizational structure. And I think those are all good things. You know, I think again, what's matter in an AI sort of execution world is taste and judgment. And I think that comes through human perspective and having some sort of creative outlook. And in the end, I want as many perspectives as I can get because I want to consider like all sorts of different scenarios before I sort of make this decision.
So if people are in love with this conversation, how people can find you, how this process works?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Mobile Raj. I'm on Thread as Mobile Raj as well. LinkedIn, you can DM me there too. And I will quickly shout out, you know, I'm at Mozilla, as you mentioned at the top. So come check out many of the other products, Firefox, obviously, but we're building, building stuff for small business tools like Solo. So you can check that out as well. Generally reachable, feel free to ping.
Wow, thank you so much for the broadcast. I'm glad some Mozilla is still around. Yeah, very good. Very good.
We're more than around.
No, but what I'm saying is like, you know, saying the environment, what I mean by around is like that powerful, you know. This is so in my browser, right? Like everybody thinks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Thank you so much, Raj, for the podcast and for all of you following the broadcast. See you now on next episode of Unstoppable, how brave entrepreneurs like Raj break that wall and achieve the first million. Bye for now.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential, audacious entrepreneurs that overcame challenges and adversity, providing you with the blueprint of how they sold their first million so you can grow your business exponentially.